New Thinking Aloud is presented by the California Institute for Human Science, Mind, Body, Spirit University, a leader in fully accredited in-person and online U.S. college degree programs in many of the topics we cover here. Visit their website at cihs.edu.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlove. Today we'll be exploring the major schools of thought within Buddhism. My guest is Gary Gock, who is an adjunct faculty member at the University of San Francisco. He is author of The Complete Idiot's Guide to Buddhism, as well as Pause, Breathe, Smile, Awakening Mindfulness When Meditation Is Not Enough. He is co-translator of three Korean books of poetry by Ko Un. He is editor of What Book? Buddha Poems from Beat to Hip Hop. He recently served as co-translator for Hafiz's Little Book of Life, and our previous interview was about the 14th century Persian mystical poet Hafiz. And I'm going to link to that interview. I think you might enjoy it very much if your computer can capture that link. It's in the upper right-hand corner of your screen. Gary lives in the San Francisco Bay Area, and now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Gary. It's a pleasure to be with you once again.
Jeffrey, thank you. It's my pleasure, too.
Last time I interviewed you, we talked about Hafiz, the great Persian mystic who I think is mostly associated with the Sufi tradition. But in addition to your Sufi credentials, you also are a Buddhist. So today we'll be looking at the major schools of Buddhism. I think it's very confusing for people because we hear about Buddhism, but most people wouldn't know the difference, I don't think, between Hinayana and Mahayana and Theravada and Tibetan Buddhism and Pure Land Buddhism. So we'll dig into those various schools of thought.
Excellent.
And I guess from what little I know about Buddhism, I'm not a Buddhist. I'm very fond of Buddhism.
Wait. You know the differences between Buddhists and non-Buddhists?
No.
Non-Buddhists think there's a difference. Okay, so you're not a Buddhist.
No. I've never taken, what do they call it, taken refuge.
Oh, taken refuge. But you know, there was a survey. Wuthno and Kaj, who are professional survey people, not just amateurs, found that 1 in 8 people said, yes, I've heard teachings of the Buddha, which I have adopted in my everyday life.
Well, certainly meditation is very commonly practiced, and mindfulness.
Yeah. And awareness of the impermanence of life and the interconnectedness of all things. And yeah. Anyway, go ahead with your splendid introduction. I like
that. Okay. Well, to my understanding, the people who teach Vipassana meditation, which I think is part of the Hinayana or Theravada tradition, say that their teachings are the closest to the original teachings of the Buddha.
As long as they say that, is when they start saying that we're the only school, we're really the best school. Because see, it's natural for human beings to do that. Yeah. So the Dalai Lama is not going to tell you about Vipassana or Zen or Pure Land. So all of these schools up until now have remained separate, also geographically bound. But in globalism, and here in the West, we have access to them. And yes, the Vipassana tradition, Theravada. We don't say Hinayana for a funny reason, or I'll get into that later. But the I say original Buddhism. There is a school that pretty much follows what the Buddha laid down 2,600 years ago. And from that we get mindfulness, and also a package called Abhidharma, which is a super dharma. It's called Abhi super dharma, which is this result of the concentration of monks in the wilderness, exploring, you know, the outermost reaches. And so it makes Western psychology look like kindergarten. Abhidharma will give you a chart of the 112 phases of consciousness, or a wheel of the 12 this, or, you know, just very an intensive psychology. And it preserves pretty much, you know, original teachings of the Buddha, of which a foundational one is, I have but one teaching. The one teaching is the nature of suffering and liberation from suffering. And you say, wait, isn't that two things? And you say, no, and you understand the nature of suffering, you will be able to liberate yourself from suffering. This is called the Four Noble Truths. Mm-hmm. And in Theravada, there's, do you hear it? Do you perceive it? Do you recognize it? Do you understand it? Move on to the next one. It's a very intensive kind of a drill, and yet, the Theravada teachers, like the most famous is Ajahn Chah, who was in Thailand, and his students would go out in the forest, and the Buddha did, and get acquainted with sitting and having a python sort of cross you, because you know you become the path. Theravada. Original teachings of the Buddha. It's a good place to start.
That tradition would be almost diametrically opposed in many regards, certainly not in all regards, to Tibetan Buddhism.
Why do you say that?
Because, and this is from my perspective, obviously, as something of an outsider, there's a certain simplicity to the Theravada tradition.
Oh.
Tibetan is complex.
So contrast. Or before I do that, if I might, invite you and I and our listeners to consider this a practice of inclusivity and equanimity. Because it's the tendency of the mind to find differences and to contrast and to compare and all that stuff. And we can really get bogged down in that and lose. I had the analogy come to me as I was getting off the bus. We're like a compass. If we remain with one leg in the center, then we can revolve around and touch all the other schools. Okay? So Tibetan Buddhism is the most complex. And it is also, it's esoteric. Meaning, if you saw the guru teaching 27 people something and you just came over the hill and you saw it, it wouldn't mean anything to you because you didn't know the password. You hadn't been initiated. You didn't know the secret esoteric meaning. So it requires a direct connection to a guru who's connected to the Buddha, and we get into lineage. Theravada, it's all the teachings of the Buddha. We're all descendants of the Buddha. However, Tibetan Buddhism or Vajrayana encompasses Abhidharma. It includes includes the previous schools, as it were, to create this, you know, like rocket ship design. That makes everything else look kind of, you know, puny.
The other major schools would be Zen and Pure Land.
There's really, today there's eight, right? One that's just based on the Lotus Sutra, on a book. And from that you get Nishin Shu, Nishin, and Soka Gakkai, where they knock on doors and offer you, you know, their dirty. Another is based on a book called the Avatamsaka, which is multi-volume, epic, gargantuan, take you years to read and study. Another is based just on ethics, just by practicing the guidelines of conscious conduct can we achieve complete awakening. And those aren't what I call the ones that you hear about the most, and those are the Theravada, Vipassana, insight meditation, original Buddhism, Zen, which has certainly been the biggest in terms of Western gateway, Pure Land, which is the largest and yet the least heard about by non-Asian Americans or Asians, and the Vajrayana as we know it through Tibetan. And that forms, this is how I arrange them in a book, as a kind of a, there's a sequential progression if you do it that way. And some of this has to do, to step back, with the way the teachings might get, you know, they don't spread like butter. You know, the teachings are the teachings. But people travel and they go to different countries. And so it's an interesting phenomenon of the compass is in the center, but it travels to different countries. And so you have cultural differences because at a different order of scale, there's as many Buddhisms as there are people. Whatever an individual hears and understands and recognizes, accepts, and practices is their Buddhist way, or their way using Buddhist along with another way. So that's how we come to even discuss these, you know, different schools.
Now, I understand that here in the United States, Buddhism is one of the fastest growing religions.
Absolutely. I think it's probably second to Islam. And in Europe, it's Sweden, it's just like overtaking everything, and large in Mexico, growing in Italy, certainly the United States, and that creates a kind of a flywheel where, oh, in Asia, they see that the West is talking about this, so then they find, oh, that's part of our native tradition, and if the West is interested in that, we should pump it up too. And so you get a kind of a crossing over the ocean of winds creating great vortexes.
Well, one of the distinctions that I'm aware of as a parapsychologist is, I know, for example, there's a very prominent individual, Susan Blackmore, who, to my understanding, is a practicing Zen Buddhist and is also identified with the skeptics of parapsychology. She would probably say, and I hate to speak for her because her views are probably still changing like everybody else's, but I'm pretty sure she would say parapsychologists have yet to prove that psi, or the paranormal, the extrasensory perception abilities of the human being, even exists at all. And that would be, in her mind, completely compatible with the ideas, the simplicity of Zen Buddhism. Whereas, let's say, in Tibetan Buddhism, you have a wide range of esoteric practices that do involve the paranormal.
Of all of the ones we've mentioned, Tibetan Buddhists have the most what they call siddhis, S-I-D-D-H-I-S, who can, you know, expand their consciousness to be the size of the city. They can levitate. They're omniscient. You know, the whole rainbow of human possibilities, Tibetan Buddhism. But see, in Zen, and I don't really know which school, because there's two schools of Zen, there's a, there's an understanding of what Zen calls extraordinary states. And when you enter into Zen, you will hear someone eventually say, you know, you'll experience extraordinary states. Don't attach to them. They come, they go. They come, they go. Don't reify them. Don't try to make a thing about it. But they certainly exist in Zen. I'm sitting, you know, I've hosted a Zen group for a dozen or so years. And how do I know on that particular Friday that for some reason I find myself kind of stalling for an extra 2 minutes. And then when I'm done, the door opens and somebody says, sorry, I'm late. How did I kind of like know that they were not in the room, but coming in the front door? I think we have that potential open to us when we practice Zen, but Zen has, especially Japanese Zen versus Chinese, Korean, or my school, which is Vietnamese, this kind of a, let's not get into that. But when you say skeptic, you know, the first thing that came to my mind was the pre-Socratic, you know, this, the Epicureans, the skeptics, and the Stoics. But she's not that kind of she's not a cynic. She's a doubter.
Yeah, you could say that, or a scoffer.
I'll tell you this: our mutual good friend, who just celebrated his 90th birthday, happy birthday, Russ. Russ explained to me once, you know, it's basically, if you read Longchenpa, the Tibetan philosopher, scholar, city, he likes the Padma edition. You know, that's, he locates what he does there in what you would call sunyata. If you align yourself with the nature of reality, which is called blank essence, infinite possibility. It's not empty in the sense of nothing matters. It's nothing in the sense of everything is possible. That it, he says that's it, you know, if he were to locate his gift, he finds it in and you see sunyata in Zen. You know, it's there. So I'm not so sure that, or I put it another way, I don't know how many people in parapsychology, knowingly or unknowingly, are also practitioners of this, for want of a better word, way, since Buddhism isn't really even a word in the East.
Well, there you have a distinction right there between the Eastern and the Western approaches. We have a word. We call it Buddhism. What do they call
right.
it?
Ah, good question. If they call it, which, you know, it's like, you know, they're always, I don't call myself anything, I'm always here. Buddha, Dharma, rather than an ism, means Buddha, which is the root for awakened, or awakening, or awakener, or enlightened, or living fully. And Dharma, taken from a Hindu practice, is there, it means way. But just like your, you know, the button shows, your yin yang is not a straight and narrow way. It's, you know, you can't define it. It's by its essence is something that you can't really pin down. So they say Buddha Dharma. Yeah, the differences between East and West. That's probably a fifth school, right?
Mm-hmm. I happen to have, over the years, interviewed many Buddhists who are also educated Western physicists, psychologists, medical doctors, and I think what they do is they try to fuse their Buddhism with their understanding of Western science. And in fact, I believe the Dalai Lama himself has held many conferences where he invites Western scholars for that same purpose.
This is interesting. So I hear two things. One, you know, Buddhism isn't just like some object on a shelf. It's a living tradition, and it's your life. As Zen Buddhists would say, there's no difference between Jeffrey Mishlov, Buddha, and Zen. It's all this phenomenon. And if you happen to be a plumber, then you Zen will be your plumbing. I was talking with a contractor the other day. He says, yeah, you know, he had this project and he realized how if he just kind of removed himself from the situation that created problems about it, it just kind of works its way out. It finds its way of working itself out. How Zen? Well, he's a contractor. If you're a scientist, this is the second thing I'm hearing. This is interesting to me because, you know, I'm a Goethean science buff. And I find Newtonian science just like, sorry, wrong number. But the Dalai Lama is an interesting motor here for bringing science into the dialogue with Buddhists. And he says, if science can show me anything that disproves anything in Tibetan Buddhism, I'll drop it. And they haven't gotten to reincarnation yet. But if you're following along, you can see where this is going. It's kind of a Trojan horse in a way, isn't it? That if he invites the great Western scientists who understand Tibetan Buddhism and gets them talking about, well, how do you measure will? Oh, you tried that in a lab. That's interesting. Our monks have done the same thing, and they find it's the same quanta. It's like 1/600,000th of an instant. Interesting that we both agree, right? But it isn't, and he's always been fascinated, like he's a tinkerer. He's always been fascinated with those, you know, with science in that sense. But I think that there's a Buddhist or an Eastern science that I can't say it's really compatible with Cartesian Newtonian thought, but I think that it's better, and eventually it might kind of ameliorate a lot of the, you know, obstacles we have, because science has always been. Science is looking at material in relation to material, right? And you see what this atom does to that atom. And now they're starting to look at the relationships rather than tagging what the atoms were. But what about the relationship between matter and non-matter? Mm-hmm. And what about the relationship between non-matter and non-matter? Like prayer is sort of in between the two. And they finally discovered randomized placebo double-blind studies at McGill or whatever have shown that long-distance non-local phenomena do affect other people. It's called prayer, guys, right? But, you know, I think they're still coming to the table of what has been going on for thousands and five to 500,000 years. More than Western science. Sorry that you pressed my button there. Right?
Well, you brought up reincarnation a minute ago, and the idea.
Oh, we're reincarnating to a minute ago.
The idea that science, if science could disprove reincarnation, the Dalai Lama would drop it. Yeah. I think that's in effect what you said. Well, science is actually doing the opposite at the University of Virginia. They're collecting thousands of cases of young children who remember their past lives, and often they solve these cases by identifying the actual previous person. But I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the Pure Land School of Buddhism does not accept reincarnation.
Oh, well, so let's be precise. The Dalai Lama doesn't believe in reincarnation. They call it rebirth. Hmm. And, you know, the question as to what gets reborn, I once had a 3-hour conversation with a Tibetan Buddhist where I finally got what they're saying is survival. Hmm. But they don't say reincarnation because that implies already that there's a fixed, permanent, a separate self, right, that will reincarnate. Because, and that also presumes that there's a heaven and a God in the heaven. And all they used to say rebirth because it's a continual process of me and that tree sharing minerals. At one point, that tree was my mother. And so we're constantly giving birth to each other, and not just human being species, all species are constantly in a state of rebirth. Pure Land. Okay. You want to tell me just a bit more about, like, maybe where you heard it or what you heard before we introduce our good listeners to this wonderful Pure Land?
Here's what I heard, and it's just the tiniest little snatch. It was the idea that Pure Land suggests that when the body dies, we return to the Pure Land, to the source. To, one might say, you know, we merge with the divine or with the absolute,
and don't come back.
Right.
Oh.
Now, maybe I misunderstood.
Well, you know, this is the least understood path by us, you know, Megwo-Ren, our round eyes. I think it would be helpful to provide a context of what is Pure Land. As the teachings leave South Asia, Cambodia, Laos, and Sri Lanka, and they go over the Himalayas, and the first time that the Himalayan culture and East Asian culture meet, they come into Asia, where you get Zen and Pure Land and so forth. And one of the differences is that is your motivation. You're no longer practicing to become enlightened for yourself, because you can't really, you know, until you get it together, you're not going to be of any use. So you go off in the woods, so you get it together. They say, you know, that doesn't really work, because you're always going to be with other people. And this is about this is about all beings. And so there's the Bodhisattva vow. You've heard of it. And it is that, I'm at the, right now, I'm coming to you from the gates of Nirvana. I'm about to attain 125% complete enlightenment. But I say, no, stop, hold, freeze frame. I ain't going to take another step until all beings can come through this door. I'm not going to do it just for me, because I don't want to be a being in a being where I'm enlightened and other people aren't, and that my enlightenment and other people's enlightenment are bound up with each other. So there was this, so we get into a sacred story here. There was a monk named Dharmakara whose practice was so great that he earned, we call it merit. It's the relationship between you and your environment. Let's look at karma for a minute. If I walk around as a blissful, calm, harmonious being, other people around me will be harmonious, blissful, and calm. If I walk around paranoid and angry, other people will be angry, and that kind of verifies my paranoia. So our relation to our environment is very important. And he was creating in his own lifetime this vastly purified, clear realm of being, such that before he was going to pass on into the light, he made a vow, and it has 48 parts, and one of them was, before he goes into the purified realm that he's created that is beyond space and time, if one says his name, he will hear you, and he will conduct you to his realm, where you will have a lotus of your own. And that lotus will enable you to completely transcend all the difficulties you had in this mortal realm, and you'll be able to attain absolute, complete, 123% enlightenment so much easier in his pure land, in his purified realm, which happens to be in the Western quadrant of the universe, as mapped by the Buddhists. So there's this concept that we create kind of our own heaven, we create our own hell, and that he created a heaven, a purified realm, that he invites other people to go to just by reciting his name. Whether we factor reincarnation into that or not, this is an amazing story. To factor reincarnation into it, I think the point is that if we don't do this, we will be reborn and reborn and reborn. It's called samsara. We won't reach nirvana, which is liberation from form and shape, form, color, whatever, the relative dimension. And instead, the flip side of the energy of nirvana is, I just keep doing this over and over. I don't know. I'm just like the rat that goes around in a cage and doesn't realize that the door is open and it could just walk out. So I think there's that sense of samsara. It is, but it isn't like preached when you go to a Pure Land temple. You know, if you don't listen to what I'm going to say, you're going to be reborn as a chicken, or you're going to be the same old, what you call it. But it may be there. It's a good question. I can ask Reverend Sensei Kobata, and he might tell me. The Pure Land people are very kind of guarded about telling anybody anything, because even that implies a certain state of superiority and separation, and that if you practice it, you'll know for yourself.
Well, I'm under the impression that that's very different than the original teachings of the Buddha, that you can just call on the name of a particular guru and achieve a measure of enlightenment.
Well, was CNN there? They all say that these were teachings of the Buddha. Tibetan Buddhists say that their teachings were terma, T-E-R-M-A, which were teachings that the Buddha said, people are so not ready for this, that I'm going to have these buried. And people will dig them up eons later when they're ready, right? They all factor their origin from Buddha, but yes, historically, Pure Land comes around, interestingly, the same time as Christ, right? Although there is a Pure Land element to Buddha, which is, if we are talking about Buddha, we've given a name to some guy, Gautama, Shakyamuni, Siddhartha. He had more aliases than a jewel thief. And we call him by this honorific, the way we call Jesus Christ. We call the Dalai Lama His Holiness. We call Siddhartha Gautama Buddha. Because when the people he'd been studying with in the forest saw him and they saw that he got it, what shall we call you? And they said, let's call me Buddha. We'll call you Buddha. And that word meant enlightened one, awakened one. Mm-hmm. And to be able to, here's my point, watch for it, look out, to be able to say this story, to be able to say the name Buddha, means that we have a seed in ourselves that we can water simply by Buddha, 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 Buddha. Not that anyone really does recitation of just the name Buddha. It's usually recitation of the Dharmakara became known as Amitabha, which is a combination of infinite light is wisdom, endless life is compassion. And there's also Medicine Buddha. When you're sick, you recite the Medicine Buddha Sutra, you recite Medicine Buddha's name, And we're back to Tibetan, where they previously had a whole pantheon of deities. And when they received the teachings of Buddha through Padmasambhava, they conquered and converted the deities to Buddhist ones. So you have a whole plethora of transcendent deities that one can invoke and visualize and instill within yourself.
Now, that's the Tibetan school.
Part of when you go to a Zen temple, you'll see a guy with a sword.
Yeah.
Who is Manjushri, and it's the sword of non-dualism. Mm-hmm. And you'll see a Kuan Yin. You'll see a goddess of compassion. So you have a deity representing compassion and wisdom, just as you have a picture of the Buddha. It isn't that they have ears to hear you or eyes to see you. It's that the representation reminds us to water and instill within ourselves our own capacities. But these are present in Zen, but they're just kind of background in terms of the everyday teachings.
Whereas I presume in Tibetan Buddhism, I've heard the term tutelary deities, that one develops a personal relationship with the deity.
Yeah, your guru will assign you your deity to identify with and then dissolve into emptiness the way everything is empty. In Buddhism and Zen, the only equivalent would be in Rinzai, where you're given a koan.
In other words, the particulars of these schools can be quite different, but I think what you're saying is they're all pointing in the same direction.
Pointing to or coming from. You know, the difference being you're already there, but you needed a pointing finger in a foggy night to know where the full moon was. Mm. The full moon being typically the image or symbol of the fully enlightened mind.
It reminds me of a tapestry that I have. I never thought of it as Buddhist particularly. It shows a poet, and he's alone at night, probably out in a forest somewhere, and he's drinking some intoxicant and sort of saluting the moon.
Is it Asian?
Yeah. Oh, yes, it's Chinese.
The Chinese symbolisms for a moon are fascinating, like the moon in the water. There's a Kuan Yin, a Bodhisattva of compassion, in Boston. Beautiful image of compassion. Not seated cross-legged. Seated with one knee up, and it's called the moon-viewing a Buddha. Because the goddess is looking at the moon and the reflection of the moon at the same time. When the reflection of the moon in the water goes away, where does your mind go?
That would be a koan, I imagine.
Yeah, actually it is. But yeah, there are the Li Bai. Was toasting the full moon a lot. Although Li Bai was also Muslim, partly Muslim as well as Taoist and Buddhist. Anyhow.
What? Like you, a little bit of Muslim, a little bit of Buddhist, and I think Taoist in there as well.
Buddhism was translated in China by people who thought that, That's our guy. He became enlightened. Oh, we don't know where he went. Lao Tzu, the old Lao, who wrote that book, The Tao Te King, the book of the Tao. All we know is that he went that way. And now from that way, we're hearing word of this enlightened guy. He must be Lao Tzu. Mm-hmm. And so they started translating Buddhism, where Wei was Tao, and everything they knew about Taoism. And much of Zen is still based on a Taoist worldview. Only I think Zen will go further, like the Taoists speak of the wheel having the empty spoke that makes it work, and the bowl having the empty center that makes it work. So they're speaking about this emptiness that we're referring to, only spatially. And in Buddhism, they go further and they talk about it in terms of temporally and other dimensions. But yeah, so Taoism and Buddhism and Confucianism in East Asia too.
So there are undoubtedly many, many varieties, many fusions of these different threads.
Right. Yeah, this is interesting that even one school isn't really separate from other schools. It's just like, you know, in America, you know, I know a woman, she's a Scottish Japanese on her mother's side, and she's African American and Filipino on her father's. You know, stuff is like that.
You've taken refuge in a Vietnamese school of Buddhism, and if I recall correctly, under the tutelage of Thich Nhat Hanh.
Yeah, man.
How would you characterize that school?
So, we were talking a bit about Pure Land and Zen. We've been talking about it kind of with the sense of the Japanese sense that these are discrete schools. That's discrete in the sense of like different addresses on a street. They're separate. Mm-hmm. The same street. Unlike Japan, but more like China, Vietnam has that syncretic, S-Y-N-C-R-E-T-I-C, affinity. It's like you go to the restaurant with a Chinese meal with a banquet, and you have a round table, and everybody takes a little bit, and so you have your own concoction. So to give you an example of what the combinations might be like, imagine you're a Pure Land. You haven't read a lot of books. You know, all you know is if you say this name, and if you do say it over and over and over, you know, you replace 1,000 thoughts with a pure thought, and you'll be in a purified realm of your own mind, of your own pure mind, whether or not you're going in the future somewhere else. And you're doing that, say, for 25 minutes. And now you say to yourself, let me give myself a Zen koan. Who is saying this name as I'm saying it? And then you can achieve Zen enlightenment at the same time as you're practicing Pure Land. So that's a fusion that's kind of very typical in Vietnamese Buddhism. And one of the first things I learned was that I'm a member of an order that was created in Vietnam, and the original members are Vietnamese. And so I'm learning about Vietnamese Buddhism from an individual who, second only to the Dalai Lama, has been the biggest spokesperson for the West. And he hasn't talked about Pure Land for Westerners, but at retreats with the Vietnamese community, that's all the kind of lingua franca. So I find it wonderful to be able to have been connected for 30 or some wonderful years with someone who has this living connection to the Eastern lineage, and who also has understood the West very well. Thomas Merton, for example, called him his brother.
You talked about the koan a moment ago. And you seem to imply, if you concentrate on a koan, like who is the one who is repeating this mantra, you achieve a kind of, I think the way you express it, a breakthrough, where like a sudden moment of enlightenment. I think I've heard the term, I think, out of Zen Kensho. represents that, a sudden moment of enlightenment. That's an interesting part of Buddhism. I don't know that you find that, for example, in Western traditions.
What? You don't have epiphany in the Catholic?
Well, perhaps Kensho and epiphany are the same. It hadn't dawned on me.
And then when we talk about Zen, we find it has a counterpart with Hasidism, started by Baal Shem Tov in Judaism, and an alignment with a mystical tradition that may even predate Islam, but is known as Sufism, the mystical side of Islam. These, I think they exist in other traditions. It's interesting how, it's an interesting point that what we know of Eastern spirituality that awakens us to our own roots in the West largely come through Buddhism, not through Sufism, and Hasidism is still relatively its own little thing. But Zen had this big explosion, I don't want to say explosion because, you know, that's kind of a military word, but I'm thinking when Jack Kerouac wrote a bestseller called On the Road, he could write anything he wanted, and then the second book he wrote was Dharma Bums, because he wanted to introduce Buddhism into the mainstream. J.D. Salinger, at the same time, in Nine Stories, introduces it with his epigram, I believe, was, "What is the sound of one hand?" So this is interesting how we sometimes have to go out of our way to come back in again, having seen something that's in our own backyard, by recognizing it without it being something we're over familiarized and kind of prejudiced about, right?
Well, we've been talking about how the schools of Buddhism influence each other, but the fact is we're in a global economy and a global world of intellect, and it's certainly true, I think, that the Western religions are influencing the Eastern religions and vice versa. I know, for example, the Dalai Lama made a point of consulting with Jewish leaders because he wanted to understand how they were able to keep their community alive for thousands of years when their nation had been taken over.
That's right. Yeah, there's many examples of this fruitful dialect. Toynbee, the historian Arnold Toynbee, said of the 20th century, the coming of Buddhism to the West has been the most significant event. And you see it in so many spheres. You know, psychology. William James says, the greatest discovery of our time is that I can change my life by changing my attitude of my mind.
Right.
I don't think he got that from Presbyterianism. He was a student of Buddhism. The transcendentalists, right, of Emerson, Thoreau, Emily Dickinson, they were reading both Sufis and Buddhists and Hindus. So my locus here, to try and find a point in this energy field, is that we're living in a time that I find very exciting as the Renaissance II. Stephen Prothero had this theory that Renaissance I had the rediscovery of Greek and Latin fueling its embrace of change in civilization and culture. Mm-hmm. We are living in a time where people are learning Sanskrit, Chinese, Japanese, Korean, and how much of a difference that makes for so much for all of us.
Was it Rudyard Kipling who wrote East is East and West is West and Never the Twain Shall Meet?
Kipling. That's Kipling. Walt Whitman wanted passage to India and beyond.
So we are living in this new renaissance.
That's the way I kind of enjoy feeling this, not as something that's separate. I was on a talk show once and a guy asked me, syndicated, 3 million listeners, Gary Gock, you're a Jew. How can you embrace a Buddhism, an Eastern religion? I said, the host was Jewish. I said, you know, Joe, is Jewishness, does that come from Southwest Asia? Or where does it come from if it's not an Eastern religion? You know, yeah. I think our sense of the division of the world has certainly been an error or a moment in our history that we are all in need of studying.
Well, it's one of the reasons why I think it's useful for the New Thinking Aloud audience to have a sense of what these different schools within Buddhism have to say and how they interact with each other and what meaning we might each find for ourselves in this dialogue.
Very good. Excellent.
Yeah.
I'm so happy that we've taken this chance. Finally, for this chance to take place.
Well, Gary, I know we've been planning this interview for many, many weeks. It's a pleasure to be with you once again, and I hope that we do many more.
Aren't you the sweet one? I hope so, too. If you like, I brought a way to walk us off the dance floor, as it were. Nothing happens when I do this. Nothing changes, that is, except I would invite you and I and our listeners to just, in a relaxed, open way, let go of any of our questions and concerns and anxieties, and just for a few breaths, returning to this present moment through the sound of this bell.
Thank you so much, Gary, for being with me in the New Thinking Aloud audience today and sharing your capricious personality and your wisdom.
Jeffrey, thank you for your life.
And for those of you watching or listening, thank you for being with us, because you are the reason that we are here.
Book 2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ, celebrating his 90th birthday. You can now download a PDF copy or order a beautiful printed copy of Issue 6 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine.